You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I'm glad I showered. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
My freezing cold shower. I'm doing that now. Do you guys take cold showers?
No.
Was like, don't be a piece of shit. Don't take a cold shower. You don't want to be that kind of person. And then I started doing it. I feel great. It works.
I'll be honest with you. I'm sure it does work. I have no doubt that it works. I just don't want to experience that sensation. I don't like that. Like, I don't like, you know, but there have been times in my life where I've done like, you know, the really cold to really hot kind of dip back and forth. And then there was one time, I think it was like maybe 2 years ago, where I did one of those cryotherapy mm-hmm. things where you know, but it wasn't the kind where, if you've ever seen them, where like you're sitting in a pod and your head is sticking out of it. It wasn't like that. It was literally like going into a little closet that was like 110 below zero, and you stood in there naked for 2 minutes. It was insane. It was the craziest thing I ever did.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. See, we're talking like cold shower, like jumping into a cold pool, and then eventually it gets warm. That's what's interesting. But you just tell yourself, we can do hard things. We can do hard things. It's my new mantra. We do hard things. That's what we do. We get in the cold shower, and then that's how we start our day. It's going well.
I'm sure it is. I envy you that you are able to do that.
Well, you know, I'm pretty much a big deal. So this is a good way to start. I like
Joe and Dan taking cold showers with Adam Pascal.
Well, put that on a headline. Here we are.
So an actor is saying his lines, and then out of nowhere, he just starts singing.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Jimmy, don't cry for me.
Well, we're so excited that you're here. Thank you for coming and chatting with us this morning. I wanted to jump into what you have a show coming up next week.
I did.
And so we heard about this. We're going to nerd out about all your entire career and all of the cool stuff. But what is this show? What's going on with this show you're doing next week?
So this is an acoustic retrospective of my career. It's a show that I started doing live, you know, before the lockdown. I was doing it for about a year or so prior to the lockdown. And it seemed like a good type of project to try and put out there during the lockdown. It was because it's just me, you know, it's just me and my guitar. And I talk to the audience and I tell stories and I talk about my experiences, not even necessarily in the show itself, but I talk about like where I was in my life during a certain show that I was in, or like, and I try and tie it all together. I talk about how I got into doing musical theater, which is a pretty unorthodox way, you know? Yeah. And I take people chronologically through, you know, starting with Rent and my audition for Rent, and it goes up through Pretty Woman. It's taken 25 years for me to accumulate enough shows on Broadway that I could put a show like this together and have like a solid hour of material to, you know.
Right.
So what I did with the version that's coming out next week, is I filmed it in my apartment that I was living in Vegas, right? And I set up like three cameras, and by cameras I mean iPhones, you know, and but 4K iPhones, like I mean like super high def.
Yeah.
And I shot myself recording all the songs live. It's all live. I've got like a studio mic in front of me and I'm just playing and singing and we recorded it on these three cameras and it's a nice black backdrop and whatever. And it looks great. But then I was like, how am I going to do the other stuff, the other part of the show, which is talk to the audience and tell these stories that are very much a part of the show. It's not just about the music. And so I really didn't want to just talk to the camera. That seemed kind of stale to me. It didn't seem like that would translate in the way that I wanted it to translate. So as luck would have it, buddy of mine, Jared Emick, Tony winner, Jared Emick, lives in Vegas. And I was living in Vegas at the time. And so I called him up and I said, will you do me a favor? Come over. I'm going to set up these cameras and we'll have a couple of beers and I want you to interview me. And that's what he did. And it worked out great. It was perfect because I needed somebody to talk to,
right.
Somebody to tell, you know, not just the amorphous, you know, void of looking into a camera, mm-hmm. but I needed an actual person to sort of play off of. And it ends up working out great. And so, and that's the show. That's what everyone's going to see. So it is live performance. You know, the music is recorded live. There's no trickery.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's just me and Jared talking interspersed.
Oh my gosh.
That sounds awesome.
That sounds super cool. That sounds like, it's like, you know, these are the things, the productive nature of the pandemic where people are like doing things like this and you know, it's very inspiring.
Well, thanks. I did a number of things during the pandemic to varying degrees of success, you know, because they're all experimental, you know what I mean?
Like this podcast.
And some good stuff came out of that. About, you know, and I just mean stuff that will carry on, in, I think, into the future, mm. certainly for me, yeah. but a lot of stuff I never want to see again.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like the virtual musical stuff, like I was so grateful to have those jobs and I had so much fun doing them and making them, but I don't ever want to do that again.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
that's not something that I was, you know, it was an interesting experience in that it was like, oh, this works great. This was fun. This was, and I would do this again. This, no, never again.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Right. I just did a lot of staring at the wall, I feel like. Sometimes I look back and I'm like, it's August?
Oh, man.
I did that too.
I did that too. I stared at the wall. I stared at my iPad for months and uh-huh. months on end. Uh-huh. You know, I can't watch any more Family Guy. I can't, although I do. but I, you know, like I can't watch any more of these shows that, you know, I've watched out, honestly.
Yeah.
Like people are like, you need to watch. I'm like, don't go any further. I'm not watching it. Whatever you say, I'm not watching it because I can't watch anymore. My fucking eyes hurt yeah. from staring at screens like my whole life.
That being totally. Said, you should watch White Lotus. It's really good.
Well, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, this is White Lotus is turning into that the new thing where it is the one of those shows that it's like, if you're not watching it, oh, you're not watching White Lotus. And I'm not watching it yet. And I talked to Dan 400 times a day. And he's like, you got to watch this show. And I'm like, you know what? I'll watch what I want
right,
to watch
all right.
when I want to watch it.
What's so special? Yeah. What's so special about this show that everyone has to watch it? What's so special about it? Go ahead.
Just rock star cast. And in the pilot episode, the first thing that happens is that you find out that someone died. So they start in the future at the end of this
okay.
vacation. And okay. then after the credits run, they take you back to the vacation at this beautiful resort in Hawaii where you know something's going to fall apart because someone's going to die. And now we're 5 episodes in. We still don't know who's going to die, but something's going to happen. So it's just, you're kind of waiting for something to happen, but it doesn't live in a place that's too dramatic. It's very much a dramedy
mm-hmm.
and all-star cast. So,
okay.
That's the sell.
Sounds terrible. Have you guys ever heard of the show Dark? The German, I think it was on Netflix. It's called Dark.
No.
That was a really amazing show. Like I don't, and I'm not saying you should watch it. I'm just saying like, I was really surprised. Like somebody had recommended to me and it was during the time when I was watching shows and I got so into it. It's fascinating. Like it's such a good show.
Wow.
Just like check out what it's about. And it's just like a total trippy, you know, mess with your mind kind of time jumping. And again, I mean, you could describe it similarly to what you just said, rock star cast, all these people, but it's in German. And so, you know, it's subtitles.
So you have to read it,
but it's just,
Dan doesn't know how to read. So
I don't read. That's awesome.
I'm sorry.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater. SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that With brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Dan, can I ask my Aida question? Can I jump in?
I just want you to know that I'm nervous, but you can do what you want.
It's not actually a question. It's a story. We Dan and I both are just massive fans of yours and your career and
Thank
everything.
You.
I mean, so much of what we love about musical theater came from the shows that you built, and you know, we love Rent. We've talked about it so endlessly on the show, and we'll get to that, I'm sure, but Aida, I have this crazy Aida story, and I've always wanted to meet you because I wanted to share this with you, and I was hoping that we'd get to meet at some point. So I grew up in Chicago, and I saw Aida out of town in Chicago in 1999, 2000, right?
Yes. It was probably, we celebrated the millennium, I think, in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. I grew up in a Western suburb, and my mom used to take me to like everything that would come to Chicago, the Goodman, Steppenwolf, the whole thing. And so she gets tickets to this new, you know, out of town tryout of this musical called Aida. And, you know, we know nothing about it. And it was so exciting to see something, you know, to know nothing. I mean, I'll never forget sitting there watching Written in the Stars with the star backdrop with, you know, and being like, how did they do that? You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was the night in previews when the tomb went up and crashed to the floor.
You were there that night?
I was in the audience that night.
Oh my God. I mean, dude, that's fascinating to me because I'm so excited to hear your perspective because clearly that was a huge event in my life. And I tell this story all the time. I've been telling it every, you know, I talk about it all the time because it almost fucking killed me.
Yeah.
So like,
I want to hear your perspective as the person. So basically I've told the story on the show before, but if people haven't heard it, so at the end when Radames and when you and Aida are buried together, buried alive, in previews, the tomb, you guys enter, you know, they throw you in the tomb together. And when I saw it in previews, the tomb rose up like 15, 20 feet in the air over the stage. And I'm sitting there watching it, and I'm sitting next to my mom, I was hearing, you could kind of hear something. I remember this like so sort of viscerally, and then something snapped and the tomb crashed 20 feet to the stage. And I will never forget. So like I was young, this happened. You guys, the thing crashes to the floor. You guys roll out onto the stage and the curtain comes flying in. And the, you know, and truly, I never heard it before in my life. Is there a doctor in the house? Over the speaker, and my mom just grabs my hand, and we bolt, and we just like head out because she was like, I don't know what's gonna happen,
yeah.
And I don't want my, you know, I was young at the time, so you know, she dragged me out of there. But we're in the car on the way home, and she goes, I'm flashing back to this. She goes, did you see Adam Pascal put his arm in front of Heather Headley to protect her from falling out? Like the thing was crashing, and she remembers you like grabbing, almost like you do like a loved one when you're driving, and you know that you slam on the brakes and you put your arm in front of him. And I remember I like have this crazy, crazy memory of this, and then a couple of weeks later, you know, we checked the Chicago Tribune the next morning, like, oh my gosh, are they going to be okay? And it, you know, comes out that you guys were okay. And we got a couple of tickets to the show a couple of weeks later. And we came back and we saw the whole thing. And the tomb was on the stage.
That's right. Okay. So that's such an amazing account because pretty much everything that you said is exactly how I remember it. Of course, I don't remember, you know, doing that, what your mom remembered, because it was in the moment. I'm glad to know that I did that, you know, that I tried to protect her. I do know that I was very concerned because actually when we just did Stars in the House, we had our Aida reunion. Mm-hmm. I forget who was saying, who was backstage, and they were saying they could hear us over the microphones. And I was like, Heather, it's going to be okay. You're okay. Like, I was like talking to her while we were laying on the stage, you know, and they could hear us on backstage. They could hear us on the mics, wow. You know? So I'm glad to know that I wasn't like George Costanza in Seinfeld. He runs out when the room's on fire. He pushes everybody out.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But I honestly remember, pretty much exactly how you described it. The only difference is that from my recollection, when the thing actually fell, it actually fell like 2 feet first, and then it stopped for maybe a second or two, and then it fell the rest of the way.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So it kind of like gave out. It didn't fully give out right away. It went like, ding, gush, you know what I mean? But that might have been something that was like imperceptible to the audience. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and it also, it happened so fast. It was just like, dun, dun, you know, but it was fast enough for Heather and I to look at each other and go, like, we knew it was happening. Like, it gave us a second to register it as opposed to it just dropping.
Wow. Oh,
so what did
gosh.
You do? Did you, yeah. How did you brace yourself inside? Like,
well, we kind of didn't really. I mean, it was so fast, you know what I mean? The whole, it just happened so fast. So whatever we did, you know, I mean, it came down. And like you said, we rolled out onto the stage. And I remember I had the wind knocked out of me. And actually, these muscles, I think they're like
transverse.
Your intercostal muscles.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I tore a bunch of these muscles which of course for a singer couldn't be the worst place to do it. I think Heather kind of like fell on top of me, or like, you know, I kind of braced her fall.
Yeah.
I don't think that one was on purpose, but I think she kind of fell on top of me. Yeah, but no, we were hurt, definitely. And here's the funny thing. A doctor did come running up on stage, a lovely woman. I don't remember this really. I remember a little bit of it, but she was a dermatologist. And she came up and she was like, I am a doctor. I am a dermatologist, but I am a doctor. And, you know, like, she was lovely from my recollection.
Oh, my God.
So
well,
but you didn't hit your head and you didn't have any more serious injuries than just, like, these torn muscles?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So we, if I'm not mistaken, that was a Tuesday night. We were out of the show Wednesday, mm-hmm. two shows on Wednesday. Our amazing understudies, Eric Scotto and Shelley Williams went on.
Wow.
Completely never in a million years would they think that they were going to go on
right.
our second preview out of town.
Right.
And yet here they were, and they got through two shows. So
with no rehearsal.
Because they are consummate
wow.
pros. But anyway, we were back in the show. You know, look, would we have benefited from a good week or 2 weeks off? Absolutely. But there was a lot riding on this
right.
situation. And they were like, if you can at all go back in, please go back in. And so we were back in Thursday night, and I was all taped up and like, you know, just, you know, but you know, look, the show must go on. That's kind of true to a certain extent. I've done that many times in my career since, like taped up parts of my body.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just to like get through it. I remember, I was asked to close. I was the final MC for Cabaret it was the most exciting, most important job I had ever had. You know what I mean? It was everything to me. And I had the most unbelievable experience. It changed my life. But on the last day, I'm trying to remember if it was the night before the last show or there was a matinee, whatever it was, I blew the fuck out of my knee on stage in the show before the last show. Like so bad that I had to leave the show. Like, I mean, you know, I left the show in the middle of the show. My understudy finished it. But I was like, there is no way I am not going to do this last performance. You know, this means everything to me. They hired me to close the show. You know
right.
what I mean? I can't not do the last performance. So again, I just taped it up and took all everything I could, you know, and I got through it, you know, and,
wow.
But you know, and again, I've done that in Memphis. I remember I hurt my arm really bad once, like on stage, I ran into the corner of a table during a scene, like full speed. And like this metal corner just like blew out these muscles. And again, you tape it up, you go, you do
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, you know, we're not athletes, you know, you want to say that musical theater, you know, that Broadway 8 shows a week is not like a high contact sport. I mean,
yeah, no,
it is.
It definitely
yeah.
is.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh my gosh.
Full on.
That's crazy.
Well, I would love to go back to step back in time prior to Aida and before we
sure.
scoot ahead to all of the other amazing things you did. So I've heard your story, read your story, listened to your story and other things, and now here we are getting to talk to you. But for people who don't know, Rent was your first audition. Is that true?
It was. That is true, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in New York, in New York City and on Long Island, and I played in rock bands, you know, my whole life. I discovered singing at a really young age, but it wasn't musical theater or being an actor that I was drawn to. It was rock bands. Mm. So being an actor never actually occurred to me. It was never something that I ever wanted to do. So I played in bands for many, many years, and in the mid '90s, I had just left the band that I was with, and I got a call from an old friend of mine, Idina Menzel, who I grew up with. She grew up literally down the street from me, and I've been friends with her since third grade. You know, it's crazy.
Wow, that's wild.
And so, and so she said, "I'm doing this off-Broadway musical, and there is a character that they're having a hard time casting, and he sounds a lot like you, and they're seeing people who don't have any prior theater experience. And I thought of you. Is it something you would consider?" And I considered it, because the audition was just go in with my guitar and sing a song. So I said, well, yeah, okay, why not? It's somebody to sit down and play in front of. At that point in my life, like, mm-hmm. that meant something. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think of it almost as an audition. I was like, you mean I can play in front of one person instead of just sitting in my bathroom, sitting on the toilet?
Right.
I was living with a woman at the time. We were living in a studio apartment, and honestly, the only place I could go to play, and I couldn't even play an acoustic guitar because it was too loud. I just had an electric guitar that I wouldn't plug in, and I would go into the bathroom. And so if I'm not mistaken, I actually think that my audition for Rent, I played on an electric guitar, but not plugged in, because that's all I had.
Wow.
You know, like I showed up there with an electric, like some piece of shit electric, you know, like guitar that, of course, there was nowhere to plug. Yeah. I think I must have been absolutely.
Amazing. Wow. I mean, and Dan and I were talking about this before you hopped on, that there's a lot of lore for all of us that love Rent and how it completely shaped the musical theater zeitgeist as we know it. There's a lot of like lore behind it. Like, what did this really happen? Did that, you know, stories or whatever. And one of the stories that I heard about your audition was that a lot of people were, I'm sure this is exaggerated, but that like, there was a line of guys who showed up to audition dressed like Alice Cooper. And you were sitting at the end of this line, just dressed like you, like a guy who just like is a musician. And it was like, oh no, like we want that guy. I don't necessarily think that that's true, but
it's not true at all.
Good to know.
Not even close.
Check it off the list. Is like that's not real.
True because look, this was an unknown thing. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Like there wouldn't have been a line of anybody lining up to audition for Rent back then, because it wasn't Rent. It was just something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I walked in and there was, from my recollection, in all honesty, there was one guy in front of me. It was like some little room that was rented, that Bernie Telsey rented. There was no place to even have people line up. It was like some little office, some little room. And I walk in and there was a guy in front of me, like some dude with long hair and like a denim jacket or whatever, from my recollection. He went in, he sang. And then I don't even know if there was anyone else there. There may have been a person coming in as I was going in, but there was nobody there. No, that story's total bullshit.
I love that. I love it.
We need to call some professors from college and let them know that they're full of shit.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's a good point, though. You know, I know that you've spoken about, and I think there's something interesting there, the ability of a show like Rent to capture the imaginations of a new generation of theater fan, which is something that we've seen now with Hamilton and, you know, with now this In the Heights movie that is going to kind of open up a new sound to like new groups of people who may fall in love with theater for the first time. Did you recognize that when did that become something that you thought, oh shit, this might be something? Was it not until Tony's and Pulitzer time or, you know?
No. Well, you know, we knew it was something before everyone else knew it was something.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And what I mean by that is we didn't know if this was going to be successful, but we knew from the very beginning that it was really special and really interesting and really different. And not only because we felt it, but just the reactions from the people in the inner circle. And mm-hmm. you know, and of course, when you're in the inner circle, you have those reactions, but there was just something about it you could tell. And there was this chemistry between the 15 of us that was just like, you couldn't, you know, it was like lightning in a bottle, mm-hmm. you know, like we just like, we all fell in love with each other, mm-hmm. you know, and we couldn't get enough of each other. And like, you know, it's only in hindsight that you can look back and see, you mentioned, Joe, how it sort of has changed the zeitgeist of musical theater. I agree with you, it has, but only in hindsight are you able to see that and go, wow, and look back 25 years, it's been 25 years and see all the things that it has wrought, you know, mm-hmm. and all the branches that have come off, you know, like Lynn and like, you know, mm-hmm. Tom Kitt and Pasek and Paul and like, and all these, like these, all these composers that are so influenced by Jonathan,
right.
And not just Rent, by Jonathan, his other stuff, whatever it is, you know what I mean? It's just, And you can hear it in the music, you know, and you can pull things out and go, oh my God, that is, you know, especially with Lynn's music, which I love because you can hear the influence, you can, but then he twists it and does such a unique thing with it. And it's just, it's so cool.
Yeah. One, I think I was just thinking about this now Rent obviously for so many, but like being sung through that Hamilton being in the Heights is, there's more scenes and stuff, but I wonder if that was at all in his head that does Hamilton sing all the way through if Rent was not written? I mean, I don't know if there is a Lin-Manuel Miranda without a Jonathan Larson, but, you know,
well, sure.
Many,
I mean,
many
certainly
things.
Not the one that exists now.
Totally. Right.
There isn't. You
right.
know?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a shitty question, but when you look back
Classic.
At that time, is there something that you take away from the whole Rent experience? I mean, it's been so much a part of your life, you know, for your whole career. Like, is there something that you value the most, or that you're like, you know, wait, that the coolest part about that whole thing was X?
The people, the relationships that I made, and the lifelong friendships,
yeah.
you know, the Daphne's and the Jessies and the Anthony's and, you know, like, and the Wilsons and, you know, it's like the love I have for these people that are now my family, you know, that's the undoubtedly the best, you know, for me personally, part of the whole experience. Mm.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
Totally.
So you start this show, which becomes, you know, a worldwide phenomenon, and you star in the movie and, you know, you go from being a rock star without any acting experience to, like, at this point now, you're a bona fide Broadway.
I did not go from being a rock star.
Sure.
Not
sure,
at all.
A rock singer.
I went from being a...
Sure, fair.
Thank you.
Fair.
Yeah, let's clarify.
Fair. I see. A true real-life Roger Davis. And, you know,
yes,
then you
exactly.
became... You kind of, like, found this career as a bona fide Broadway actor in
yep.
dozens of shows. And, yep. and did you ever have a moment where you were like, what the fuck am I doing here? I don't belong here. Did you ever start training?
Yeah.
No.
Well, the training for me has always been like, you know, I have a sort of an interesting relationship with that concept.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate enough to get all my training on the stage.
Sure.
People have been crazy enough to hire me to do things that I didn't know how to do and allowed me to learn to do them on a stage on Broadway.
Sure.
So, you know, that's where my training has come from, and it's been invaluable. And I wouldn't, you know what I mean? I couldn't have asked for better training than that kind, because that's what works for me. You know what I mean? See, I just got sidetracked. I got distracted. What was your original thing? What were we talking about?
Just, did you ever feel like you didn't belong? Like,
oh yes, I always did, especially in the very beginning, those first few years. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until Cabaret that, because doing Cabaret for me did so many different things, you know, personally and professionally. But I knew after Aida, I had to make a leap, in a way, a leap of faith in myself and take a risk, knowing that, like, if I didn't do something that showed that I can do more than people have already seen in these two shows, then I was going to get pigeonholed as just like the Broadway rock guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I aggressively pursued that job in Cabaret, you know, for the entire run it was on, you know. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had to succeed in it. I didn't know if I could, and I was terrified once I got the job. But I did, and that instilled in me this respect for this thing that we do, and this newfound respect that I didn't have up until that point. Mm. And it also showed me that I could work incredibly hard at something and have it pay off. I'd never done that before. Not hard in the way, and honestly, but not. And when I say work hard, not in the way that I learned that role in 2 weeks and nailed it on night one. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I worked, because that's all you get is 2 weeks. And so I think I probably rehearsed, between actually being in a rehearsal studio and all the work I did at home, like, you know, 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day. Like, I was just like, I have to get this in my skin. It's got to be in my body before I hit the stage, or it's not going to, I won't be able to do what I want to do, you know? So it changed my life in that way. And also, again, and then people in the industry said, oh wow, he can do other stuff and he can act, you know? But especially when I got the Tony nomination for Rent, I felt so guilty. I was like, how in the world did this happen to me? Mm. And how did Jesse not get one? How did Anthony not get one? I was like, I felt terrible and I felt so guilty. And I was like, I'm just a fucking poser. Like, and these guys are like, you know, real actors, and I get one and they don't, you know. Like, it really bothered me. I didn't have the reaction that one would think that you would have when you get nominated for a Tony. I was like, what? What, are they crazy?
That's it's super interesting.
It was like one of those roles that you, and you are brilliant in the role. I actually got to see you when you and Anthony came back to close Broadway.
Okay. See, I was much better then, I think. We didn't come back to close Broadway. That wasn't Anthony and I. We came back in 2007 for the summer.
Got it.
And then we did the tour in 2009. Yeah. No, I think that was Renee and Will, I think, that did the, and who was Mark? God, I can't even remember who Mark was in that closing cast. Anyway.
I got to see you in the background of the orchestra. Yeah. It was epic. Super epic.
Well, it was great for us to be able to come back, and certainly for me to be able to come back and do the show again as a more seasoned actor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And because I found so many more things, and I was actually able to enjoy doing the show a lot more. Mm. You know, vocally I was much stronger. I knew how to take care of myself by that point. Mm-hmm. It had been all these years later, you know. And so it was just a much more pleasant experience for me.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. You touched on that. I'd actually love to know the vocal health, vocal training sort of stuff, because you have one of the most iconic voices of this ridiculous art form that we love. Did you ever take a voice lesson or train with people, or was it, what, did you get your training in truly like in clubs and singing in rock bands, and how do I sustain this life?
Yeah. I kind of did. That's really sort of where it came from. I'll start by saying whatever I do and however I've learned to do it, I'm assuming that I have proper technique. Because I don't lose my voice. You know what I mean? Mm. Not that I don't have vocal issues and have problems like everybody else, but you know, I never had nodes. I never had vocal cord issues. I never had like that kind of stuff. I get fatigue. I get tired. I get phlegm. I get all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But like, so I think for whatever reason, and again, it's just luck, I've developed a proper technique in the way that I sing. That doesn't mean that every note that comes out of my mouth is done with proper technique. I do all sorts of crazy things with my voice, and I use different parts of my head and face and body, you know what I mean? Especially when I'm doing my stuff, not necessarily in musical theater, but, it came out of, you know, I used to sit in my bedroom with headphones on, big stereo headphones, and, you know, in the early 80s, listening to, you know, Iron Maiden records and mm-hmm. listening to Ronnie Dio records and singing along, but having to sing so loud that I could hear myself come back through the headphones. You know, I wasn't mic'd, I had these headphones on. And also these guys were such powerful singers,
right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
And Queen and Journey mm-hmm. and The Who and Zeppelin. Like I always gravitated towards strong singers,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and even Billy Joel, Elton John, who I adore and have sang my whole life. Like, you know, they don't get enough credit for their singing. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys are great singers, and their style of singing is I mean, you know exactly who they are immediately. Nobody sounds like them. Like they are unique vocalists, those two. And I always try and say that to like give them both, you know, like they should get more credit for that.
That's a really, really good point that I am thrilled that you brought up, because it's something I've wanted to say on this podcast and highlight, which is that Joe and I went to Michigan and studied musical theater. So we're basically the opposite of you. We like went to school and they were like, this is how Broadway must be done. Learn it this way then go and figure out what it will be.
Well, with Michael McElroy about to be at the helm, I don't think it's going to be taught that way.
I agree. I think they've drastically shifted the go ahead, Joe.
And that's huge, actually. Michael McElroy taking over the musical theater program in Michigan. We haven't actually talked about it on this podcast yet, but that is the greatest decision in the history of decisions for the next generation of musical theater majors at the University of Michigan. We have to say
I
that.
Agree.
So anyway.
For sure.
Yeah.
The point I was trying to just get to really fast and just highlight of something that you just said is that, like, it's okay to sound different and be different. And I think that Joe and I lived in this generation where we were all trying to sound like someone or like everyone in this weird way. Like, I have these couple of voices, and yours is somehow one of them, but your voice is so uniquely you that no one could ever do that. And I don't think that musical theater performers, when they're younger, allow themselves or are taught to do that. Like, as we bring pop music back into musical theater more and more, it's going to be even more important that you have these like unique characteristics to your voice to really call to how pop music functions, because of all of these artists that we listen to who never sound like anybody else.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And I always encourage that when I work with students and I do master classes, is encourage their uniqueness and what makes them them. Now, look, especially when you're young, you know, when I was a teenager, I just wanted to sound like Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, and so everything I sang sounded like Bruce. You know what I mean? It was just like, and the guys in the band were like, do you have to sing with so much vibrato? And I was like, that's what I do, man. You know, because that's what Bruce does, you know? So I get that, you know what I mean? And it takes a long time, and it takes an active continuation and process to find who you are. I'm still finding it. You know what I mean? I think it's a constant evolving process, you know, when you're in show business and you do something artistic, and it should be. Mm-hmm. It should never, you know, become stale and stop. Like, and so I'm like, vocally for me, I'm still trying to push myself. I'm still trying to be a better singer. You know what I mean? And you know, I don't want to be one of those people that, like, as they get older, they lose their voice. You know what I mean? For me, like, I want my voice to get better and stronger and richer. And quite frankly, it has, because I push it. You know what I mean? But to get more back to your specific point, more uniqueness needs to be encouraged, and I think it is because of the eclecticness of the styles of music that are being produced on Broadway and becoming popular, you know, parts of, as you say, the zeitgeist of musical theater. So it's going to require unique voices, you know what I mean, out of necessity, you know, I'm glad that you guys are embracing that, you know, that concept, because it is so important. It's what makes anyone stand out. Anyone who is a successful singer on Broadway, if you think about any of us, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Who are the stars? None of us sound like each other.
Right.
And, you know, and kind of none of us sound like anyone else. Like, so,
right.
So it's interesting that that uniqueness is not pushed more, because uniqueness is clearly what is celebrated, and it's what elevates people to stardom, because all of the stars on Broadway who do Broadway have a unique sound. There is something about all of our voices that is, you know, uniquely us, you know. Idina doesn't sound like Kelly O'Hara, and Heather doesn't sound like Lilias White, and Heather, you know, like whatever it is, you know, like whatever comparisons you want to make. I don't sound like Norbert, you know what I mean? Like you can compare, you know, you could, any of us, and so it's I think that it should be encouraged more because it's, again, because that's clearly what works, but yet somehow the opposite tends to get enforced, right?
Yeah. That's and I realize as an educator, it must be a double-edged sword because I think a lot of, I came into school being heavily influenced by voices like yours and shows like Spring Awakening and came into college kind of like growing up listening to Fall Out Boy and pop punk. And like, that's what my voice sounded like. And I could have just kept going in that direction and carved like a really unique lane for myself. And I kind of still have, but my teachers were trying to foster a richer, more developed sound and encourage me to do things that I didn't do. So it's not that they were trying to push me, but.
Right. Well, but see that, and that's what needs to happen. They need to take what's already there, your existing talent, your existing instinct, and nurture that as well. Not try and at all stifle it, because what a great look. I look at it. I think of these things, and this is something that I have worked on in my career, which is developing different characters for my voice so that I can sing in different ways and sound in different ways depending on a character that I'm playing.
Right.
And not so different that it doesn't sound like me, but just, you know, and I consider that, you know, having tools in your toolbox as an actor and as a singer,
right.
You know? And so, you know, if I can sing a show like, you know, or just, I not that I've done it on Broadway or anything, but like music like Hedwig, okay, like a real rock score, like that's real. I mean, you know, when I think of a rock score, I think of Hedwig, like that is real. Like I put that on, you know, in my rock mix, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, because it's just such awesome rock music, you know? Anyway.
You've never done Hedwig?
No, I haven't.
Oh my God.
But anyway, so don't distract.
No, sorry.
There's that. But then, you know, if I want to sing The Phantom or if I want to sing Les Mis, like I have to sing a different way. I have to bring out a different tone and I have to approach it differently vocally. And so it was really important to me and continues to be able to do that depending on the show and what I'm doing. It makes me versatile. It makes one versatile. It's like being able to speak in different accents. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I sort of look at it as a similar thing. But no, I've never done Hedwig. I love Hedwig, but no, I've never done it. I sing the music all the time, but I've never been in the show.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm putting that out there. Can we please?
Me too.
I hope people get a lot from what you just said, because that is incredibly valuable for anybody who's trying to develop their voice, and you know, and even for Dan and I mean that's just,
it's a really good point, because super great. Like I say, I wish that I followed my unique sound more, but I also wish that I had something like a Jesse Mueller has, which is like the girl can sing every style. She can go from Carousel to Carole King to Sarah Bareilles, and it's still her, but it's very much the right style, and that's what you have to do, you know.
I agree, because you know, we want to be able to be as versatile as as castable as we can, you know what I mean? And to me, that's what's so fun about this career, is to be able to disappear into these other characters and play make-believe. I mean, that's what's so fun. And I mean, it really is like sort of like the best career. You get to play make-believe and dress up and sing amazing music and get paid moderately well for it. You know, so.
Oh, that's so good.
Classic. What would you say has been the greatest challenge that you've faced so far?
Not quitting when things get really hard, which is most of the time.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah. You sound like us. You sound like you've been listening to our show.
Well, no, from my perspective, that's the job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have a career in show business, and my job is to not leave that career in show business when things just get desperate, which they periodically do and always will. You know what I mean? When I get hired for something, those aren't jobs. That's the prize. That's the prize that I get for sticking it out over and over and over again and not quitting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so for me, that's the job, is to just do all the things that I need to do to not quit and not give it up because I just can't stand it anymore. You know what I mean? Because look, I wish that I was somebody. And when I first got into the business, I was like, I got a thick skin. I thought I had a thick skin because everybody loved me and I was the star of Rent. And, you know, but I don't, I don't have a thick skin. I don't deal well with rejection. I don't like not getting parts, which I do often not get parts. People think, oh, they're knocking down your door and you're constantly getting offered this and offered that. That's so not the case.
Right.
And I go for long periods of time where I'm not in a show.
Right.
You know, luckily, I have this aspect of my music career where I go out and I do my own gigs. And that has been a mainstay of my career lots, you know, over the years where I wasn't in a show, you know. But point being is that it's a miserable business. It really is. And I don't sugarcoat it. If you want somebody to tell you how wonderful it is, then you're going to have to ask somebody else.
I love that.
The prize of doing work, is what it's all about. And I love it so much, that's why I keep doing it. And now I'm so far into it, I can't get out of it.
Yeah.
Now it's 25 right. years in and I'm 50 and I'm like, what, I'm going to give it up. You know what I mean? And,
right.
and go, you know, look, I wish I had the skills to be a carpenter. I would use them. I really would use them, but I can't go back and learn that now. It's too, you know, when I'm 75, I'll be a good, successful carpenter. I don't want to spend the next 25 years building a new career, you know?
Right. I love that so much and couldn't agree anymore.
It's like he's been inside my head.
It's like he's been Damn. Inside my head. I mean, and us, but just with the last year, especially, I mean, and Dan and I, you know, we've gone through massive right. bouts of unemployment, and the last year has been so incredibly
sure.
depressing that it's like to hear that from someone like you is so... It's like misery loves company. You know, we're all going to be okay, and we're not at the same time. You know?
Yeah, well, that's right, the thing. Right. I think, look, I do the best I can, certainly in recent years, to try and live in my truth, you know, and that's not always been easy for me. But one of the ways that I try and do it is when I'm asked things like this and not that I've ever really been someone to sugarcoat stuff, but to be honest, I've been doing this long enough now that I think I have a little bit of wisdom. You know what I mean? And so I know that, like, I talk loud and I curse and I gesticulate and, like, it's like, I probably have an air as if, like, I know what I'm talking about. You know what? I do know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, I probably talked the same way with the same air of confidence and maybe didn't quite know what I was talking about. But I think now I do. Now I feel like I'm confident in my own wisdom and that I've navigated this business for enough years.
Yeah.
I've done enough things. I've seen enough things. I've had enough experience that I think that my wisdom carries weight to it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. We ask everybody, is there a book or a resource or something that you found invaluable in your career? Is there something like, you know, you talk about living in your truth or you know, it can be an album or something that you're like, oh, this is my, you know, something that really steers your ship?
No, I haven't. I have found things about the world and life and the things that interest me that keep me engaged. You know, in recent years, I have, again, it's about this sort of pursuit of truth, you know, and I follow people who I feel are good guides in the pursuit of truth, you know, and I listen to people like Sam Harris and mm-hmm. the late Christopher Hitchens and Ricky Gervais and, you know, Lawrence Krauss. And, you know, these are all scientists and philosophers and authors and people who, you know, who are interested in the nature of reality, you know what I mean? And the universe and culture and humanity and our brains and all of that stuff. You know, that has occupied a lot of my mental thinking in recent years. And I'm just really excited by those things, you know.
I love that. Yeah. And there is such access to it through podcasts and through, you know, like, you know, making it sort of, you know, the democratization of information in that way. I love that.
Yeah.
Love that. You know, we ask everybody what your the most influential musical is on your career, and it doesn't have to be something you've done. It certainly can be, and it sounds like Cabaret. I mean, we talked about it a lot earlier that may have really been, you know, sort of a big
a big sort of, you know, shift in your career, but is there something else? Are there any other shows that are incredibly influential to you that you found?
I love doing comedy and so getting to do Disaster and then Something Rotten, I think was really, really important for me personally, again, and career wise. I think people said, oh, wow, he's funny, you know?
Right.
And so, and that, again, talk about tools in your tool belt, that opens up a whole new world. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know, I would love to play Max in The Producers, you know, like nobody would ever look at me and think that, but you know what? I'd kill that role.
Yeah.
and it's, you know, and I love doing comedy, you know, and in all honesty, like, it's kind of like my favorite thing. Like there's nothing more I love more in this world to laugh. And there's nothing more I love than to make people laugh, you know? And so, to be in those shows and experience that, and to work with these other comedic actors who are so brilliant, who I learned so much from, you know, between everyone in Disaster and then Rob McClure and Josh Grizzetti and Blake Hammond and all these people, like, I just learned so much, you know. You're around these people, Roger Barton, Kevin Chamberlain, and Faith Prince, and Carrie Butler. Like, you're around these people. You can't help but absorb, and Jen Samard. You can't help but absorb the funniness, you know. So I think that's been super important for me of recent years, you know.
I love it.
What advice would you have for somebody who's starting out? If you could go back, it could either be for, you know, a omnipresent somebody else, or it could be something that you wish you'd known, that you wish that you had done earlier, or something like that.
Or for Dan and Joe,
Yeah, right. That's usually how it ends up.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just that if you can understand the uphill battle, and that it's always going to be uphill, it never plateaus. Mm-hmm. It may the slope will ease and the gradients will change, but it's always uphill. And if you know that, and if you're prepared for that, that's, I think, the best advice I can give you, or anybody in going into show business. Like, choose A-list actors. You know what I mean? Granted, their issues are different, but to a certain extent they're not. And I used this example yesterday, and I don't know why I just pulled her out of the air, so this has nothing to do with her in particular, but like I said, take someone like Jennifer Aniston is arguably an A-list star. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean,
yep.
Not even arguably, she's clearly an A-list star.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston undoubtedly doesn't get a lot of the roles I'm sure she wants.
Right. Right.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Right. I'm sure that there's lots of things that like that Nicole Kidman gets, or that this one gets, or that one gets, that she doesn't get. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That she really wanted to, and it hurts her, and it makes her feel rejected, and she goes through the same things that I go through when I don't get the show, or that you don't get the show.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it's important for people to know also that it will never get to that place, and you will never not feel rejected when you don't get something, and you will always not get something, even when you get to the level of Jennifer Aniston.
Right.
You know what I mean? So.
Totally. Totally. Totally.
Right.
Oh, that's so good. That's so good.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
But it's also unifying.
Yeah. No,
reality that needs to be accepted.
Yes.
It's a reality. If you are going to survive and not kill yourself, because, you know, it's just a reality that you have to accept. Understand, look, in any business, in anything you do as a young person, if you're moving ahead in life, you should be as well informed of this, whatever chosen career you're going into, mm-hmm. of what the reality of that career is, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. And so, and with show business, most people don't give you the reality.
Right.
You get some bullshit Instagram version of what you think a life in show business is, and you go, I want that, which has always been the nature of show business.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? It's, I want to be a star. I mean, that's always what, you know. But,
yeah.
You know, I've lived through it, so I can tell you that it's, you know, there are things that are wonderful, and then a lot of it sucks.
Well, and I think, too, that there's something, I was just thinking about this, that, like, there's this, I think we're the only career where somebody says, oh, I want to make it. I want to make it. I want to, you know, oh,
right.
I've made
Which
it.
Which is such an amorphous concept.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Exactly. And then,
what does that look like?
And it's bullshit. It's a life of slowly climbing uphill and having the gradient change. as opposed to making it, because you know that I don't think that that expectation is on any other career, and also it shouldn't be on ours because it is bullshit.
Right. And you know what, like, you can make it. You're so right, because it's so funny in show business. It's like, I want to make it, which really is an amorphous idea. And it never actually happens, because whatever making it is constantly changing and different for everybody.
Right.
But there are industries where, like, just now that I'm thinking about it, we're like, okay, if you say, I want to be a cardiac surgeon. Well, if you become a cardiac surgeon in a hospital and you save people's lives, you've made it. I've made it. I've done what I set out to do. I've made it. You know what I mean? So there, in other careers, you actually can make it. So if you want to make it, go into a different career, because your show business is not the career to make.
Exactly. Because it's not a meritocracy. It's not about how hard you work. You're going to work really hard for shit you don't get. It's fleeting, because even if you do book the thing that you've always wanted to book, it will come to an end.
It will come to an end, and eventually, no matter how hot you may be, because I've gone through this, eventually you won't be.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you could get, again, it'll go up and down, but like you're of interest in the moment. Like, I'm doing a ton of press right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, I've got this concert coming out. I'm talking to people. I was on press all day yesterday. I'm getting all this narcissistic supply. I'm talking to people and everyone's telling me how wonderful I am. And it's so nice to talk to you. And I'm talking to this outlet and that outlet and this, but you know what? After today, it's over, and I'm not going to talk to anybody for months on end. So it's like, people need to understand the reality of what it is. You know?
That's awesome. That's
you just
awesome.
Need to store it away store in the narcissism ego bank and let the and then take as long as you can to let it defrost.
That's so funny. Well, we're getting to the end. We're so grateful that you talked. It was actually, well, here we'll say this. It was so horrible talking to you. This was terrible. So, but our last question that I always like to ask people is, I call it the unreachable star question, which is like, you know, what are you pointed towards now? Is there something on the horizon that you really want to do? Like you said, comedy, like you want to do more comedies, you want to do the producers. Is there something that you'd really love to accomplish now, even after you've accomplished so much?
Well, I want to continue the longevity that I've had, you know, I want to just continue to work and continue to follow paths that are laid out in front of me that maybe weren't there yesterday. You know what I mean? That's been a really exciting thing about my career. So I don't have any particular goals, like I want to accomplish this, or I want to get on a TV show, or I want to do, I don't, you know, I enjoy, quite frankly, having steady income.
Sure.
And so I have a family, and I have a son in college, and I'm going to have another son in college. And like, so I want to accomplish continuing to work
wherever that
can be, you know?
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For sure. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and for, you know, living your truth, for sharing your truth with us. And, you know, I just wanted to highlight, like, when I fell in love with musicals, and I'm sure Joe feels very similarly, a lot of people said it was corny and it wasn't cool, but you were one of the people that made it cool. And I guess I'm thanking you for that, even though you were just being yourself, but it is really amazing to get the opportunity to talk to you on this show, this idea that Joe and I had, and for you to share your truth with us here is just a true blessing. And I want to thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate that. And I'm humbled by that. And I'm so grateful that I'm part of this community and have had any impact whatsoever on anything.
It's the best. Thank you so much, Adam. This was
truly,
truly.
Thanks, guys.
And like, I will, you know, I made the joke, but it really was just amazing to talk to you. And we've been fans of you for a long time. So
thank you. And thank you I'm so glad that you told me that story about Aida. I've never met anyone who was there that night. So I'm actually, it's great to talk to you.
I've always wanted to. I was like, oh my gosh, maybe I get this opportunity to, but like, in what context? Because like, if we were to work on something together, like if I was like in something rotten, I wasn't going to come up to you on a 10 and be like, hey man, so what's crazy is that, you know,
you know, so it's
remember when you fell?
This is like, it was a perfect opportunity to tell you the story. And actually, I was doing Frozen back in 2019, and I told Tom Schumacher, and he had a similar reaction. Okay. He was like, I've never met anybody who was in the audience that night. And he tells us, he told me he was like, you know, we were on a plane back to Los Angeles and basically landed and got right back on a plane and came back. You know, and so I just, an unbelievable sort of little piece of musical theater history that I didn't even know that I was, you know, a part of.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. And I appreciate you telling me the story. Thank you.
Yeah. So best of luck with the concert and everything else.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you for this. And hopefully we, you know, be awesome to work together. And
I hope so, man.
All right.
If you guys become big actor, director, producers, remember to hire.
Yeah, exactly. In a rock star comedy. In the rock star comedy.
Yes, that would be good.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. Awesome. We'll talk
to you
soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are now part of the Broadway Podcast Network.
Woo!
We are hosted by Dan Tracy.
That's you.
And Joe Carroll.
That's me.
We're produced by Ryan Kincaid, and Matthew Mucha is the social content manager.
You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals, on Twitter at Musical Guys, or the old-fashioned way at www.guyswholikemusicals.com.
If you'd like a chance to be featured on the Ask the Guys segment of our show, please call 203-900-7990 and leave a message with your question. As always, thanks for listening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.